rated M for mature.
Welcome to the Lost Pages of Norse Myth. I'm Jason Weiser, your narrator and host of the Myths and Legends podcast. Each month, join me here as we reveal a missing page of the Prose Edda, the ancient manuscript that contains all of Norse myth. It's said that these lost pages tell the story of a mysterious god from a distant land and his young son as they embark on a perilous journey across the Norse realms. I present to you now the seventh lost page, The Sundering of Jotunheim. Inside the enormous hall, a great iron bell rang out, its deafening gong echoing across the immense stone walls of the chamber. "Treachery," an impossibly deep voice bellowed, shaking the very ground. "We have been deceived." Odin and Tyr stepped backwards from the six colossal thrones before them, as the air in the room grew heavy and warm. They shielded their ears from the bell's deafening rings and stepped backward in retreat. The giants erupted from their thrones in unison, intent on capturing or crushing their unwanted guests. Enormous hands descended toward the pair of gods, as Odin and Tyr turned to flee, clearly outmatched by this host of giant foes. A hand with fingers the size of tree trunks reached to grasp the gods, but there was a sudden flash of light as Odin transformed into a silvery hawk and flew deftly between the fingers of the enraged Jotun. Tyr cursed the Allfather's power, for he had no such command of transformation, and was quickly overcome by the Council of Giants. He watched as the hawk grew smaller, then disappeared with a defiant screech through the window high above. Below, Tyr struggled helplessly against the iron grip of the giant. He braced himself for the single squeeze that would snuff out his long life. Breathing deep, perhaps for the last time, he closed his eyes and thought of better days. Years earlier, Tyr, the god of law and justice, stood on a high ridge of land to face a gathering throng of thousands. Before him, in an ordered congregation, stood an army of squat and surly dwarves, a host of erudite elves, and 1,000 stern and hardy men. Corralled among them were many strange beasts of burden, pulling wagon loads of supplies, tools, and, naturally, a healthy stock of drinking horns. Behind the assembly rose 3 colossal giants, standing tall in silence. In a single motion, the giants, carrying enormous tree trunks, slammed their walking sticks into the earth, causing the others to jump, and, in the case of the dwarves, to launch into the air. "Tyr, the igniter, he who summons us, all hail," they shouted in unison. Tyr turned his wizened eyes to each group and smiled, returning a deep bow. He had gathered them for a singular and noble purpose. They had all journeyed far, with the promise of easing travel between the realms forever. Too long had the realms been separated by distance and isolated by solitude. Tyr sought a lasting peace, and he knew that uniting the realms was the only path to achieve it. And to make it so, they must unite to create something magnificent. Each volunteer lent their time, skill, and craftsmanship toward the creation of Tyr's great temple. The giants plucked trees from the valley as if they were pins, and redirected the flow of rivers by dragging their fingers across the earth. The dwarves and men hewed stone from the mountainside by the wagon load, while crystals brought by the elves imbued the earth, stone, wood, and water with their mystical power. The labor lasted many long years, but at last, the Temple of Tyr was complete, a hub of massive stonework in the center of Midgard's great caldera, his gift to the Nine Realms as an everlasting symbol of unity. As its power to transport sparked to life, all manner of men, elves, dwarves, and gods passed through the mystic portals of the temple, bringing news of distant lands, trade in goods and services, and always hearty appetites. The mingling of the world's kin filled Tyr with an immense sense of pride. As Tyr stood again on the high ridge, overlooking his final creation, the ground shook beneath his feet. He was overtaken by an immense shadow and turned to face the trio of giants. "My brother," one spoke, "our work here is done at long last, but I have yet one favor to ask you in return for our toil." "I will do anything in my power in repayment for your aid, old friend," Tyr said. "Now that the journey to our lands may happen in but the blink of an eye, I implore you to send forth your mighty lord, Odin, so that we may broker a peace between our people. His son's long campaign of destruction and murder of the Jotnar is a bitter poison we choke down day by day." his terror must end. I will speak with the Allfather, good giant. I too wish to see an end to his remorseless rampage. We will see you in your mountaintops before long. With that, the giants departed for their homeland. Indeed, persuading Odin to agree to broker an accord with the giants came easier than expected. I've been eager to try out your colorful new bridge after all, Odin smiled. By your leave, of course. Tyr knew Odin's beguiling humility to be a thin veneer of grace. It was always wise to look past the charm of Odin's words to find a truer meaning. They traveled hence, through Tyr's portals to Jotunheim together, a land that, to this point, had been closed to Odin, its secrets far out of reach. In time, the two approached the enormous Hall of Giants, and without word, two stone doors as tall as the walls of Asgard opened slowly, with a thunderous lurch, revealing a hall larger than any chamber seen since by the eyes of men or gods. They entered with caution. Throughout the hall were great tapestries of art, murals to an ancient history, and tributes to fallen heroes. Wooden triptychs adorned the walls and floors, each depicting a mythic story painted into the wood and carved with intricate runes. "We welcome you this day under a banner of truce, Allfather," spoke a booming voice high above the heads of the two gods. "But know this, we would just as soon squash you underfoot as hear what you have come to say. For 30 years, your demon son Thor has waged a bloody campaign of genocide against our kin. Mountains have been made of their corpses, and our rivers choke with their blood. And yet, still, his father appears in our land to discuss an accord." Odin approached the council. "I, too, have come seeking a truce this day, for my heart lays heavy by the deeds of my son. He acted beyond my wishes, and his hammer flies without my consent. I have come to offer a peace." "In exchange for what?" questioned the central giant. "Some treasure? A few Vanir skulls crushed into powder? Or perhaps our finest giantess to carry home to Asgard? We dare say she would scarcely fit into the bedchambers of even the Aesir's mightiest lord." The surrounding giants snickered at the thought. Odin ignored them and continued, "What I seek in exchange carries no earthly cost. Indeed, it's free to give. I come to your land in search of knowledge itself. And at my side stands Tyr, Lord of Justice and Honor, as a trusted agent of my goodwill." Tyr stiffened, bracing himself at this unexpected assignment. He would no sooner vouch for Odin's honor as he would challenge his eight-legged horse to a foot race. Odin continued, "I seek not the knowledge held today or wisdom from our past. Instead, I desire foresight. I wish to know the winters to come, and perhaps a glimpse into our own future. In exchange, I vow before this council that I will deliver unto you Mjolnir, the very hammer of Thor himself. Only then will you realize peace in these lands." At this, the giants gasped and clamored among themselves. Odin, awaiting this very moment, used this distraction to steal a closer inspection of the tapestries and triptychs in the chamber, for this was the true purpose of his journey. The accord was but a ruse. Odin would never strip Thor of his prized Jotun-slaying hammer. He desperately desired the foresight to see and alter his own doom, and he only needed to get close enough to glimpse it. He was prepared to offer nothing in return. Odin effortlessly set the details of the tapestries and triptychs to memory. The final triptych was the most remarkable, as he had not yet heard this tale foretold. He glimpsed the visage of an untamed warrior, accompanied by his son, traveling towards a mountaintop. Odin was only able to spy this forbidden knowledge for a moment. He had been spotted by one of the council. His ruse had been discovered, and the alarm had already been sounded. Tyr's eyes snapped open. The recollection of his beloved temple and the tale of their journey here seemed like a distant dream. And he looked up now to the face of the giant whose grasp he would not escape. "Tyr, hear us now. We know your heart by deed and bond of fellowship, so we spare your life now. On one condition, that you will travel back across your rainbow bridge and return to your temple. There, you will forever seal this passageway to Jotunheim from all the realms. You will sunder the connection to these lands, most of all from Odin, who, forever after, is our sworn enemy. Our race will be recalled from Midgard to live here, sequestered in sacred peace and solitude, until the breaking of the earth." The giant glanced toward the triptychs Odin had spied. Odin came here to seek not knowledge, but a means to end our kind in a foolish bid to outlive his fate. His story is foretold. It will come to pass, as will yours. The giant placed Tyr roughly back on his feet. I stand ashamed of these acts, my brothers, Tyr spoke. I once stood shoulder to shoulder with Jotun in the building of our great shared temple, with a solemn intent to build a bridge rather than more walls. Yet your request I must respect, and will see to it in haste. My parting wish is to not see your folk pass into legend, but if they do, it will be with honor. And with that, Tyr departed toward the portal in the mountainside, a faint hope lingering in his heart that this would not be the last he'd see of Jotunkind. And high overhead in the mountain peaks, a silver hawk descended through the treetops and touched upon the ground, returning to his Aesir form. Before stepping back through the safety of the portal, Odin glanced back over his shoulder, a wicked smile forming on his lips. The seventh lost page has been revealed. Now journey across the Rainbow Bridge to follow God of War and PlayStation on Facebook and explore the realms of men, elves, and gods. You never know what secrets you might find. Join us now as we build the world of God of War with Luke Berlinger, senior concept artist, and Nate Stevens, senior staff environment artist, in today's Behind the Scenes chat.
So you guys just want to introduce yourself and talk about what you do on God of War 4.
My name is Nate Stevens. I'm the lead environment artist, in charge of a team of about 30 to 40 people, depending on what we're up to. My job is to take the art that is approved by Corey and the VizDev team and turn it into 3D. You know, so everything you run around and see collide with all the environments, I have a hand in that.
And my name is Luke Berliner. I'm the lead environment concept artist. So we draw and design what all the worlds look like. And other interesting thing Nate and I have been doing is kind of helping to push a lot of the visuals together on this game. So that's been pretty fun.
So in this game, Kratos is in a brand new, unfamiliar world. How did you want this world to look and feel different than the previous God of War games?
In the beginning, there was a really small team that got together to start this game. I wasn't on that team from day one, but I ended up rolling on when there was about 20 people and there was a lot of ideas pitched. Anything from let's totally abandon what we'd done before, meaning these big set pieces with giant titans and all that stuff, and go really minimalist and really realistic. That seemed attractive for a while, but it really wasn't the DNA of the studio. And so we've sort of found this happy medium where, you know, it's everything is a little bit more realistic, but it's still, we're not chasing realism per se. Like it's, we coined a term.
Mythical realism.
Yeah, mythical realism. And so that guides us, because it's very easy to get caught up in reality. Oh, let's make this rock look totally real. But now it's like, no, but this actually looks cooler this way. And it's okay because it's more of like a movie.
I think a lot of the art direction for the previous games was sort of like a heavy metal magazine meets Greek mythology. And this game, like Nate was saying, like they tried going a lot more minimal. And once we started putting level design to that, we realized like it really didn't work out. So we just kind of scaled back, and the mythical realism has three kind of pillars to it. So one is like historical detail, one is sort of mythology, and the other one is sort of like heavy inspiration from like 80s fantasy movies. So I think even trying to get the color correction and stuff like that to kind of look very filmic and for it to be a little bit more intimate than the previous games, like still have big set pieces and stuff like that, but they are a little bit smaller, but the camera is closer to you, so they're just as impressive.
So in Norse mythology, the realms are a big deal. Is that something players will experience in this game? And well, just even before that, what are the realms sort of for a layperson?
So the nine realms are basically held in the branches of the Yisidril tree, and they're sort of all connected, and the gods can be in a lot of different realms, and they sort of travel between. And man is really just in Midgard. Kratos, coming from Greek mythology, wasn't really aware of this stuff. So sort of like him in Midgard, which is more like Earth and is much more of like our palate cleanser. It's our touchstone for reality. So when you do go to the other realms, it's much more fantastic. But as you go through the journey, he sort of learns about the other realms and is taught sort of how to move between them to accomplish like his ultimate goal for this game.
In Norse mythology, the realms aren't super clearly defined. They are defined, but they aren't visually defined. What did you look to for inspiration for all the realms?
So Corey really drove this by doing a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to match like Helheim, I believe, is supposed to be like a cold realm. So okay, let's at least get the broad strokes correctly. You know, Alfheim is the realm of the elves, and so we thought, okay, you know, how can that, you know, be sort of the overarching look? But I think we have taken some liberties. But again, I think we're trying to be pretty true to the mythology until it doesn't suit our story anymore, right? And then we'll switch around. Just like we did for the old God of War games, like we took some Greek mythology and changed it around. Like Kratos actually became the God of War, you know, he overtook Ares. That doesn't happen in the canon of Greek mythology, so we'll probably tweak some stuff.
Yeah, it was actually kind of nice to have such a blank slate. I mean, you've seen some of the realms in like popular culture in some movies, but we really wanted to push our direction in a different way. And a lot of the times you read about them and they're very short. And there's some paintings and drawings that have been done in the past, but they're not in the style that we're doing and they're so minimal. So something like Alfheim, you know, working with the Light Elves and then also adding in our own like story and gameplay elements and sort of trying to like mix the mythology as well as what we're trying to do in this game.
How many different designs did you go through for each realm?
I'll let Luke field most of that question.
So in the beginning, like finding the realms was pretty challenging because you want each one to look very distinct when you go to it. So, you know, if somebody is streaming the game, you want to be able to like look at a small icon and go, oh, they're in, you know, Helheim, or they're at end of game, or they're running around Midgard. But to find each realm took forever. So we've been working on this game for 3.5-4 years, and hundreds, if not thousands, of drawings and paintings have been done. Just to find the look of Alfheim took like 3-4 months, you know, to find Helheim a couple months. Like, so it's really, it's hard to almost schedule that out because you don't know where you're gonna go. And eventually you'll find a drawing or an image or you'll read something that'll just click and it's sort of, everything settles into place. But until that, it's kind of can be a little bit nerve-wracking because it's like, we gotta start making this, but still not happy with where it is, so.
Sort of back to Midgard, what were your inspirations for the Norse Wilds?
So this is kind of an interesting story because we did this initial pitch to Sony where we made, you know, you were supposed to be in Midgard in the mountains and the artists, we all ran off and we made some rocks and bushes and trees and everything. We didn't necessarily do our homework all the way. And so when we did the demo and it was successful to like the executives. They said, we like your idea, proceed. But after that, we kind of did a postmortem, looked at it and we said, this looks like the Sierra Nevadas. This doesn't look like, you know, a Norse forest. So we had to make some tweaks because the Norse areas are a lot greener, wetter. The trees are actually shorter. There's a lot of moss. There's not a huge amount of variety like you see in some of the American forests.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you start learning more about the ecology in some of these places. And like we actually went to Iceland, which doesn't have a lot of forest, but I actually also went to Scotland, which the Highlands, they had a lot of forest that were just like what we got in the game. And with the bristlecone pine, or no, Scots pine.
Scots pine.
The needles are like really acidic. So when they fall on the floor, they sort of like make the soil not really friendly for a lot of shrubs that you'd see in the Sierras and stuff like that to grow. So it is much more barren on the ground. And so that was the big kind of difference.
Yeah, and even then, we have a guy on our team who's from Sweden. which is you know close to that area. And he runs around the game all the time. He's like, that's not right.
Yeah.
You know, this is the force of my childhood was not like this. And so we've tried. Maybe we haven't totally hit it, but we have, hopefully after this game, another game where I think we can... you know, improve on it.
Yeah.
Not that it looks bad by any means.
It's definitely our best effort.
It sounds like if you're considering how the, you know, things hit the ground and all that, like the ecology of the system, it sounds like you guys hit it.
I mean, I'm a native Southern California guy, you know, and like rain is not something I'm used to and fog is not something I'm used to. And the Norse, there was early feedback when we were doing levels. It's like, this doesn't feel Norse enough. We kept getting that feedback and it was like, honestly, a little bit annoying. We're like, well, how does something look Norse? And then it sort of all dawned on us eventually. It's like, oh yeah, Norse, you know, when most people consider it, you know, it's very foggy and wet and gray and murky, where we maybe had the sun a little too yellow and stuff. Okay. So our game now is very atmospheric. There's lots of fog, and I don't think that people feel like they're in California.
Yeah, it was actually hard because you're talking about growing up in down here. I actually grew up in Northern California in the Sierras. I think a lot of my touchstone for what a forest was is like the Tahoe National Forest. And so, yeah, that was pretty hard to get over. Or even like the redwoods and stuff like that. This game can't look like that.
So like I said, one of you mainly deals in 2D, one of you deals with 3D. What are the challenges? What's the process look like? So it's like from start to finish and getting something from conception to 2D to 3D to playable.
So I actually think there's like several kind of key stages of the project. The beginning is like previs. We'll be doing paintings. There's no design sheet. There's nothing. Like we'll be talking with Nate and his group and trying to figure out like what's actually achievable from a technical standpoint. You know, are we doing a big interior space or are we doing a big forest? And then we're inspiring the level design. But about the middle of the project is kind of when everybody meets. And once the level design exists, that's when, you know, we have to be painting over 3D and we have to have a much better understanding of the actual space. So when Nate gets it, it's a little more achievable.
I mean, we're finding there's a bunch of challenges that we weren't particularly aware of until we rolled up our sleeves and got involved. So like Luke's group will paint very beautiful pictures. And in the past games, we could just go and we really were like unshackled to make exactly that. We had a fixed camera in the game. So we could just, you know, a lot of times if you look at the original concept art and the level, they're like pretty close. Now you can spin around 360 and run right up to stuff. And so like a lot of the paintings just serve as like a guidebook for us. Yeah. And also on a, you know, practical level, this game, like just the textures and everything are 4-8 times as large as they used to be, but the Blu-ray disc is the same size. So we get a piece of concept. Now we go, okay, now how can we make this? Where in the past there was never a how, it was just like, okay, let's do it. And so we do a lot more sharing. It's tricky. Sometimes we can't actually pull off the concept exactly. So we're okay, we just gotta get as close as we can.
Yeah, sometimes like it's just a suggestion or just sort of like a collaborative effort to make the world. And other times it's like, you know, this is the shot and, you know, it's something Corey is really, really passionate about. And we'll spend months in VizDev, like everybody's tuning it, making sure it's right. And the crazy thing I think now is technically you guys have been able to get it looking like better than the paintings or right there at times, which is like incredible.
Yeah, we try.
Yeah.
Wow, so you actually start with paintings. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's
really cool. I mean, we first start with a narrative pitch. So Corey came up with a story. And from there, it's like, okay, cool. So people just go off and make really outlandish, cool paintings. A lot of them's like, that's awesome. We could never do that. It's too big or too detailed or whatever. And we sort of just narrow it down. That's what he was saying. It takes months to lock in the look of a level. And then we also look at the competition. We don't want to look like another game. It's like, maybe Uncharted did this, so we need to find our own thing that's a little different. I think we have that. In this game, there's a couple of levels that are unlike anything you've seen in other games, just from a design standpoint.
Been like one of the coolest things, too, is that, we have this rich mythology to pull from, and Corey's written like a really awesome story, and everything like Corey wants it to be kind of rich with story. There's so much stuff that we've put in like effort to contextualize things that people probably will never pick up on, but hopefully it's just sort of in the subconscious.
Any sort of hints or anything like that?
What we're doing with the world tree,
yeah,
I think is very cool because just the initial, you know, the first thing you start with is like, hey, there's a giant tree. You know, I think initial ideas were, yeah, it's under the ground and you go in this big cave and there's a big magic tree there. What we ended up with was, I think, much cooler, where it's really integrated into this architecture and it's tree-ish, but someone pruned it and like carefully guided it along the walls. And, you know, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's unlike anything I think I've seen in any other game. And it fits the narrative really good, and the realm's really cool. It's like, oh, wow, look at, so the world tree and the way that it fits with how you travel to the realms and stuff is very, very cool.
And I think that's like a really good example of where we've worked to contextualize like design mechanics so that it fits into like a really nice art wrapper so that our worlds can look really good and not feel super gamey, but still be gameplay friendly. And it's also a good example of how we've sort of distorted the mythology when we needed to.
How do Kratos and Atreus' surroundings add to the narrative of their journey?
Yeah, I mean, so when Corey wrote the story, it was based on going through the realms in a certain order and using the description of those realms, you know, to the advantage. For example, we said Helheim is very cold. So that fits into a part of the story where that matters. We didn't really just go off and make a bunch of realms and say, okay, well, make a story around this. It was the opposite way. Like, the realms were laid out in the story, and so the realms have to have certain characteristics to guide the story.
Yeah, he's sort of,
you know,
like
the mix.
Bull in the china shop. Like, no matter where he goes, he sort of, like, pokes, you know, where he probably shouldn't. Yeah, and so it's sort of, like, awaking all the gods to, like, his presence.
Yeah, and he is a monster in the previous games. You know, Kratos is not necessarily a good guy, but in this, you know, in this tale, you know, he's finding that.
It's pretty awesome, especially, you know, now that he has the son, like, you know, one thing that's really cool is, like, on the concept art for, like, Atreus, you know, you talk to Della and Raph's group, and it's, like, even just, you know, some of the way that the kid is sort of like halfway between the Norse like traditions, like the way that he wraps his legs, but then also like he's, you know, has some of the Spartan kind of thing. So you kind of see like how Kratos has influenced that and how Kratos' past like has gone through that. So yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Kratos is still Kratos, but with another dimension.
Cool.
But I think if you're a fan of him, and I think people were frankly getting a little bored of just the one-dimensional vengeance guy, you know. And it's not that he doesn't have that, but, you know, now he has to raise a kid and he's probably not suited to it.
Yeah.
You know, and we have these, so I've been on the franchise since God of War 2, and we have these things called Kratos rules. For example, Kratos does not step backwards from a fight. You know, Kratos, there are certain things he does that are just, you know, he's a Spartan warrior, so, and we're still trying to have that. You know, he's still the ultimate, like, warrior, very efficient. But I don't know, I think the fans will like it.
Okay. Just, like, adding more to him.
Yeah, we're adding more to him, more dimension.
More depth.
Yeah.
But they're not losing the old Kratos.
Yeah.
Just seeing a different side that maybe he had.
And there's actually, like, it's funny, because he's such a, like, sort of serious, sort of one-sided character. I think in this game, Corey's really working to, like, give him a little bit more depth. And if you read a lot of the Norse myth, there's quite a bit of humor in like the stories. Like, there's a story about like Thor losing his hammer and dressing up like the goddess Freya to go like marry himself off to the giant to like go
I
get his hammer.
Story, yeah.
It's like really ridiculous. And so we don't have anything like that crazy, but you know, there is quite a bit more like humor, I think, in this game than
there's a little bit. And I think if you're into the Norse mythology, there's lots of nods to stuff that I think just the general public may not be aware of. You know, like, if you know some of these characters and their personalities, there are slight moments of humor. You actually saw that in the E3 trailer. Kratos throws an axe at this, you know, tinker type character. You know, and he kind of like acts, you know, indignant, like, oh, you did that. So there's a lot more acting in this game. and a lot more emotion. At the beginning, I think we're all sort of skeptical, like, Kratos is a sword of violence. And violence is easy to do in video games, but now we're doing a little bit of feelings, a little bit of humor. And I have to say, it's turning out well. Some of the stuff really hits. Like, you can, like, oh, I'm feeling kind of emotional here.
Yeah, I saw the video from, like, behind the curtain. It's just, like, just the acting, the depth of, like, the acting and everything that goes into it. It looks like a really, really cool game.
Yeah.
Back to, like, the worlds, what sort of new challenges or obstacles will Kratos and Atreus kind of face in the new environments? Are there any environmental hazards in the game?
Yes, there are lots.
Okay.
I mean, because that's kind of game design 101 is everything's sort of like a door. Like, you run into a level and something's stopping you.
Yeah.
Whether it's a puzzle or, you know, combat. But it all functions as a door, you know, because it's like we want to give the player a sense of achievement. Like, you came in here, you were stuck. Get yourself out of it. So there's lots. Like, the example we used about the world tree, explosive world tree roots blocking you, and you have to kind of logic your way through it. The game does have puzzles, not nearly as many elaborate ones as we used to do. I think they're more based in the environment.
Yeah, there's some cool ones, too, where, like, they've added fun little, like, scenarios where almost, you know, you have to sacrifice the axe to, like, keep yourself alive in an area, and then you fight, you know, fisticuffs and stuff like that, which is really actually quite fun. So,
talking about that kind of concept of doors, as you design a world, how do you ensure players know where to go and what to explore? Because it sounds like there's a lot to this game. There's a lot of, like, all the Nine Realms, and even, I'm sure, Midgard itself is huge. But
yeah, so this is actually one of the hardest ones.
Yeah.
Especially on this game, we do not have a camera cut.
Sorry to interrupt. I've been hearing a lot about that. Like, camera cut, what does that mean exactly?
You are a third party following Kratos, and you're sort of running around almost as a ghost watching stuff. So you can go from combat to a cinematic, and the camera never clips, it never changes its angle. It's always just sort of travels.
Yeah.
And what that means practically is we can't cut the camera to say, hey, look, see these stairs, go here.
Yeah, like, and we did that a lot in the old games. Like, all of a sudden you'd enter a room, the camera would cut, it would sort of fly through and show you, like, the puzzle elements.
Tell you your goal.
And now, I mean, we can't do that because it gets really, like, stretchy and it doesn't feel great, so.
Yeah, so we've come up with, like, visual markers. So the game has to look really beautiful, and we're trying to make more, you know, it's a video game, of course, but we want it to be an experience, you know, also. And if we were to just put, like, a red stop sign on every hall, for example, tell you when to stop, some games can do that, hey, no problem. But for us, it kind of breaks the emotion. The easiest way to break the emotion is to, like, throw game mechanics and make them obvious game mechanics for the player. So when we're trying to guide you, we try to do it subtly and in a way that you're not like, oh, hey, game developer, I see what you did there. And it's a very hard line to cross because sometimes, typically, art, my group, won't go far enough. And Corey will be like, I don't know where to go. And so we'll have to kind of keep, you know, pushing the envelope of, oh, did this do it? You know, these markings here, did that draw your eye and make you run over to this wall, for example, that you're supposed to climb up?
And a lot of it just comes down to, like, focusing on good composition and, like, lighting and making sure that, you know, there's good contrast and it sort of, like, naturally just flows you through. So, yeah, it's pretty challenging, though.
Yeah, it's a hard one.
Yeah, it sounds like a challenge to have that sort of path, but also have the players feel like they have freedom and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They do more in this game. Like, one of the pillars of this game was exploration. You know, I think we've been pretty open that it's not open world. You can't just see a mountain and go, I'm heading off that way. But there are forks in the road and paths you can take, and you can go backwards and do stuff. Me as a game player, this is my favorite kind of game. You know, it's not an open sandbox. You know, there's a very tight narrative and a great story. But I'm sort of free. You know, I don't have to just run down a corridor, force into the next action, run down another one. We kind of did that in the last game. This one is much more, you know, forks in the road. You have some choice.
Yeah, I think it's almost like kind of similar to designing like an amusement park where you can look and there's these big like POIs or, you know, points of interest off in the distance. Like, oh, I want to go, you know, over there. And you can make some choices to go there. And especially with like the Caldera Lake and Alfheim and some of these places, like, you know, you can just boat around and get off at a beach and go explore. Like, you know, there might be something kind of hidden, you know, a dungeon or something like that. So it's, and that's a big departure from the old games.
Yeah, like you mentioned the Caldera Lake, and it looks like there's a mountain they're traveling to. Can you tell us more about designing those locations?
It starts with the 2D always.
I mean, that mountain, it's sort of like an ever-present, like looming focus in the game. And even just designing that, like, we did so many paintings of what that mountain could look like. And for a while, we were even trying to think, like, maybe we can, you know, maybe the mountain could have, like, a bit of a spirit to it and it could look almost like have the shape of an animal or something like that, or like the tip of an arrow. And even talking about like, oh, you know, maybe this is like the tip of an arrow that slayed like a giant or something like that. And so just kind of like bouncing around a lot, and we just couldn't find it because it's such a kind of iconic thing in the game. Like, it just, nothing was really hitting. And one of our artists, Jose, was doing, funny enough, the pack art and the key art that went out for E3. And the mountain was prominently there, and he painted it there, and we're like, that's it.
The mountain.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
So
it's right there. It was an accident, sort of.
Yeah.
So what challenges are, what's the best part about developing art for a game like God of War? And, like, what's the most frustrating?
I mean, on the 3D side, this is, it's a pretty hard studio to get into. Like, if you're an aspiring artist, we have some, you know, junior people that are very good, but most of the team is very experienced, 20, 30 years in the business, former art directors, leads, other places. And that's because we try to, this is, some games just by their nature just can't be that good looking. Like, we have the goal to make the best looking game ever made. You know, will we do it? I hope so. If not, I think we'll be very close. But that goal, like, makes it very fun to work here, because, you know, quality over quantity is sort of our mantra. Like, everything's got to be awesome. And we're at the stage right now where, you know, I'm sort of flying through the game and drawing red boxes around, that rock doesn't look good, up-res, you know, these bushes we need to replace, and just getting it to be, you know, combed through with a fine-tooth comb. And some games, they don't even attempt or try that.
Wow, like down to the rocks and bushes. That's,
yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And the square footage of this game is much larger than previous ones, which surprised us. Typically, we've made 10, 15-hour games. This one is much bigger than that, just from a size. So, you know, we're all realizing, oh, man, this is going to be hard to perfect every corner like we used to. So we kind of have to prioritize and stuff. But the art is a major selling point for these games and for first-party Sony studios.
What are your frustrations and what's the best part?
I think, like, probably one of the hardest parts to deal with always is to, like, take what the level designers have come up with, and then to, like, sometimes it might not make a lot of architectural sense or something like that, but it's a really fun space. And so, to me, like, that is the most difficult but also the most satisfying problem to solve, is, like, how can I take something that they've designed that's really fun to play and make that look as amazing as possible? And it takes quite a few tries, and it sometimes it takes, like, bargaining with the level designer of, like, can we kind of move this or make this a little bit different? But when you get it, and when these guys make it in 3D, and you walk around it and you play it, and you kind of lose the level design, like, it doesn't look like design sheet, it looks like a real place, that's pretty satisfying, and it's one of the more challenging things.
That's probably the most challenging thing for us, is that design, they're in charge of fun. They're not in charge of makes any sense, right? So they'll look at this puzzle, it's super fun, and we look at it and say, well, okay, what is this? You know, it's like, because they will basically use primitive shapes and boxes and planes and go, look, you do this thing and you do this thing and you do this thing and it's really fun. But, like, so Luke will have to come up with, okay, well, what are these things and how do they fit in and not look like an obvious game mechanic? And, you know, it's really hard to contextualize stuff because we don't want them to look like a puzzle. You know, you want it to be a puzzle, but you don't run and be like, oh, there's the game design puzzle. We want you to run around and be like, oh, I'm stuck. Okay, and everything feel like it's supposed to be there.
Yeah, that is, like, yeah, the hardest thing is I'll go to, like, a level design kickoff and they'll show me something and I'm like, wow, that is really fun to play, but I have no idea what this is gonna be. And so then I'll leave, or, you know, one of, like, Mark or Abe, one of the other concept artists, will leave and we'll just be scratching our heads and kind of go like, okay, we just have to make this look awesome. And we always somehow find a way. But yeah, it's a great challenge. And kind of one of the fun parts about the middle to end of production is like VizDev, environment art, systems design, combat and level design. Like we all have goals. Like, you know, our goal, Nate and I, is like to make the best looking game ever. And then, you know, Rob Davis, his goal is to make like something that plays really well and is really fun. And so everybody has a core, really important thing, and you kind of have to come and bargain and like understand another person's problem, and like maybe they're, you know, they have a much more legitimate reason for why it should be this way. And so you kind of have to make a sacrifice on your end to really hopefully accommodate that. It's...
He made it sound pretty smooth. It's more like a bunch of cars crashing together. Yeah. Yeah. It's like everyone wants to do their thing, win the race. It's like one of those demolition derbies.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, something, usually it's pretty clear to pick out who's supposed to be the winner here. Like, okay, yeah, this combat's really important here. So, okay, we have to either take out some art, or, you know, the puzzle's really important, or sometimes none of them. It's like, this just needs to look cool. Yeah. In those cases, we just make it look cool.
So artistry's like a really big calling card for Santa Monica Studios. How high do you set the bar for yourselves when you're approaching a new game?
Well, I mean, step one is we look at the competition, you know, because people are making awesome looking games. Naughty Dog, Uncharted, those games look amazing. So we go, okay, we have to beat that, or at least meet it. One thing that we have as an advantage over some other studios is just the subject matter we're dealing with. You know, yeah, if you're going to make a World War II game, yeah, it's only going to look so cool. You know, even if the fidelity is the best in the world, it still is World War II. We have the opportunity to do these big set pieces. Like in the trailer, there's a giant dead guy in the back. Like, yeah, what is that? You know, so we can do that. So the spectacle that we can do usually helps us like push to that, you know, wow, that game looked awesome, you know, kind of goal that we've set for ourselves.
Yeah. And as an artist, like, I don't know, everybody enjoys doing different things. And like, I think a lot of the artists that find themselves here really like that fantasy sort of mythology genre. Like they probably grew up reading a lot of stuff, watching those movies. And so to be able to like go to work and make like a giant frozen giant in the ground with architecture all around it that you explore, I think it, you know, kind of puts a smile on your face every day when you come in. And it also like puts a lot of pressure though, because we have such talented artists that, you know, if we design like the look of something, somebody's gonna invest, you know, a lot of time, like maybe a year of their life, into realizing that. And so, you know, you better deliver something that is awesome for fans and also for them to come in every single day. And
so, sort of a last question, do you have a favorite realm in the game?
So I end up touching a little bit of all of them, because I'm pretty hands-on with like the lighting and the final polish of a lot of the levels. What we've done with the World Tree, which I brought up earlier, I think is really cool. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anyone do it. The artist who was on it just absolutely nailed what he was doing. So I look at that and I say, okay, I'm very proud of this. But I mean, there's lots. Helheim, I think we came with kind of a strange idea for it, and it's I think it's going to pan out good. But yeah, not all of the stuff is very common, I would say. It's like we're trying to, you know, push the envelope. So I'm kind of proud of the whole package. Like the fidelity is there everywhere, but I would say the temple in the middle of the lake is probably my favorite.
That sounds like a really interesting idea, because the World Trees in Norse mythology is such a kind of an abstract concept, you know? Like you can't, worlds on a tree, it's, yeah. So that's really cool.
I think we've gone with something pretty clever.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's kind of hard to pick a favorite too, but I do love that temple. But even just like a simple forest, you know, in Midgard, I think it's really like awesome. So there's pretty much pockets of amazing stuff everywhere. So it's hard to choose.
Well, you guys have done an awesome job. The game looks beautiful. Look, Nate, thank you so much for sitting down and talking.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. Yeah.